I wanted to share with you this little ditty that we in neutrino physics use all the time. It came from John Updike. The story is that he was taking a physics class at Harvard and was bored, and so he jotted the first version of this out at that point. And it's the standard model version because it claims that neutrinos have no mass. I especially wanted to show this because Barry Holstein and I wrote a review article, sort of popular review article. Oh, sure. Neutrinos, they are very small, they have no charge and have no mass, and they do not interact at all. The Earth is just a silly ball to them through which they simply pass like dust maids down a drafty hall or photons through a sheet of glass. And I wanted to show it because Barry and I put it in a review article recently, a popular review article, and the next thing we knew we got a bill from the publisher for $400. So I'm trying to get my money's worth by showing it over and over again. So, absolutely. I got to get it down to $10 a time or so. So I'm going to go way back to 1926. That's where the news will start. And people were looking at the process of beta decay of a nucleus of charge Z to another nucleus of charge Z plus 1 with an electron coming out. And 1920, and there were a number of measurements that were done in the 20s. Marie Curie did some. And the one that caught my attention was done by James Chadwick's group. And they measured the energy of the outgoing electron, and naively you would take the energy release as the Q, the so-called Q value, as the mass of the nucleus of charge Z minus the mass of the nucleus of charge Z plus 1, and that should be the energy of the electron. So they expected when they did this measurement that they would see a line spike of beta rays coming out from the source. And they didn't see that. Now, of course, these were experiments, and these experiments were done in solid sources, and in a solid source, an electron can lose energy. They were also confused because when they did the measurement, they saw a certain number of lines. So it looked like there was something coming out that was just discrete. That turned out to be confusion because those lines were actually from internal conversion, another nuclear process. And Chadwick's experiment was sort of definitive because he decided to do calorimetry. Instead of really trying to measure the individual energies of the electrons, he measured those electrons and the total energy deposited by the beta rays in his source, and he showed convincingly that the energy of the average energy of the outgoing electron was less than expected, about half what was expected. Oh, thanks. And it was a remarkable note in his group's article, that perhaps this indicated that there was some unobserved radiation associated with this decay. And that idea was independently raised again in 1930 by Wolfgang Pauli. He did it in a letter. He was invited to a conference, could not attend the conference. He had a social engagement instead. So he just wrote a letter to the organizers about this idea. It started off, "Dear radioactive ladies and gentlemen." And his idea was that there was another particle associated with the decay. Now we know it's a neutrino. And that neutrino was very weakly interacting, non-interacting, and so it escaped detection and carried off the missing half of the energy that was not accounted for. And Pauli was very sort of embarrassed about this suggestion. Others at the same time were wondering, since this was near the beginning of quantum mechanics, whether maybe something fundamentally was wrong in quantum mechanics. Perhaps energy wasn't conserved in the same way it is macroscopically. So Pauli considered this hypothesis to be a pretty desperate a suggestion. That's how he termed it. And he was also very embarrassed because he said in the letter that he had done a terrible thing, that he had proposed a particle that might not be measurable. So it was a very different style of physics in those days. And and interestingly, Pauli never published this. This letter came out in 1930 until 3 years later, 1933, the Seventh Solvay Conference. And then he wrote up in the conference proceedings this idea of the neutrino, which he knew from the spin and statistics would have to be a particle that carried spin a half, so like an electron. Now, Pauli did give a number of talks in the next few years, and one of the people that was present for several of those talks was Enrico Fermi. In 1932, Chadwick again played a role in this. In 32, Chadwick discovered the neutron. And it was recognized that then there was another constituent of the nucleus, the neutron. Incidentally, Pauli, while he had this very nice and correct picture of the neutrino being produced, thought of the neutrino as some kind of a natural constituent in the nucleus that was being knocked out by this process. So it's a very different picture than we have today. Anyway, Chadwick introduced the neutron, and then in 1934, Fermi built a little theory of beta decay in which he used the neutron. And so he would view this as a decay of a neutron to a proton, producing an E minus and a nu E. And his picture, to make it a big picture of what he was doing, he built the theory in an analog with electromagnetism. In electromagnetism, you could have an interaction of a proton and a proton with an electron, and it was scattered through the electromagnetic field. And his picture of this process was just the same, that it was a conversion of a neutron to a proton, but that the interaction appeared at a point. Oops, we'll move this up here. Producing an electron and a neutrino as a result. And so it was basically electromagnetism, but with this long-range field removed and a contact interaction placed here. And the contact interaction was given some strength called G. Fermi. They wrote a weak interaction Hamiltonian corresponding to this with this weak coupling constant G. Fermi. A current associated with the flow of this neutron to a proton, and then a current associated with the production of the positron and the neutrino. And but otherwise was like electromagnetism. Now an important part of this was from the beta decay, one could guesstimate the strength of this weak coupling constant and then describe what the size scale was of this apparently point contact. And if you do that today, plugging in the value for G Fermi, we know what this really represents is not a point contact, but the exchange of a very massive particle called the W boson. But the W boson mass is much, much higher than any of the natural energy scales in beta decay. So in quantum mechanics, you can violate energy conservation for a very short time. So the W is produced and then reabsorbed. But since it can only be produced and live for a very short time, it can't travel very far during that time. So if you put in how far off the energy shell is and how, and therefore how much you violate the uncertainty principle, you can quickly show that the size, the range of this interaction is something on the order of 0.002 Fermis. So something on the order of 1/1000th the size of the nucleon. So it's in that sense that this is an effective theory that Fermi wrote down. It said that this is so short range that in terms of the physics that we can measure, you can just count it as a point interaction. And then the fact that it's weak is that to interact with a proton or a neutron through the weak interaction, you have to put a lepton, a test particle, extremely close to that guy before you have a chance of interacting. So that accounts for the weakness of all these weak interactions. Now,
what sort of experiments was all this based on?
Primarily in beta decay. So there are a lot of natural isotopes that live for long periods of time and can be studied in the laboratory. And you could, by that time in the 1930s, they were getting better and better at measuring the actual energy distribution that came from a beta decay reaction. So an important test of Fermi's theory was now that you had this interaction with Fermi's golden rules, you could use this Hamiltonian to actually calculate the decay rate and the spectrum of electrons that you would expect to be accompanied by this unobserved neutrino. So that was one of the great triumphs of Fermi's theories. He calculated that decay spectrum. And what you get is something of the following. If lambda is your decay rate, and you look at the differential rate for producing a beta ray of a given energy, that this thing goes like the momentum of the electron, the energy of the electron, this Q value, the total energy released in decay, minus the electron energy squared. So this is just the neutrino energy squared, times this constant he introduced, Fermi's constant, and then some nuclear physics, nuclear matrix element that turns out to be on the order of 1. So from that, he could just measure as a function of the possible electron energies. The electron energy would vary from the electron mass all the way up to this maximum value of Q, form this nice bell curve. Compare that to an experiment, and indeed it matches the experiment quite well. Now, one of the problems in weak interactions is that, in fact, this G Fermi is so weak. That's why the experiments are so hard, why the field takes a long time to develop. So this was 1920s, 1930s, and we're still doing neutrino physics in the 21st century, and that's because you have to have massive detectors to see the neutrinos that are produced. You can calculate neutrino ranges, so you have a neutrino, and with the same weak interaction Hamiltonian, many things can occur. One of the possibilities, for example, is you can take a neutrino from a reactor and scatter it off a nuclear target. It'll produce a positron. Again, this very short-range interaction will convert a proton to a neutron. So if you have a target of water, for example, and a source of a lot of neutrinos, neutrinos are produced in, as a byproduct of the nuclear reactions that occur in a reactor, then you can hope to see the neutrino interactions by the produced positron in this reaction. If you calculate how far this neutrino would go, that would this is a neutrino reaction. You can also look at the inverse reaction, for example, and try to produce a neutrino, as we did in beta decay. If you calculate how far a neutrino would go before it begins to interact by reactions of this sort, the distance it goes is 1 over the density of matter times the cross-section. The cross-section can be calculated from that Hamiltonian. What you find out is that distance corresponds to 10 to the 21 centimeters if the energy of your neutrino is about MeV, which is the typical energy of a reactor neutrino. And this corresponds to about 10 to the 11 Earth radii. So that's the fundamental difficulty with neutrino physics, is that neutrinos pass through matter and only very, very occasionally react. So you need simply massive targets to have a chance for detection. So it's no surprise that it took some 25 years after Fermi's suggestion before the first neutrino was detected. It was done detected by two experimentalists, Rhinus and Cowan. Cowan won the Nobel Prize a few years back. Rhinus won the Nobel Prize for this a few years back. So this was done in 1956, and it was this reaction shown over there, that an antineutrino produced from the Savannah River reactor interacted it in a water target, so the water was a source of protons. That reaction produced a neutron plus a positron. So he could detect the positron from the Schrenkroff light in that detector. And then this important thing here, this guy captured in the water. Actually, he added cadmium to the water, so you'd have a large capture cross-section. So on a nucleus, this neutron would capture and produce a gamma ray. So they were able to see the positron produced in the gamma ray in coincidence to deduce the number of interactions that occurred.
Can I just ask a question?
Yes.
Say there were no neutrinos, what would the world be like?
Well, for one thing, if you did measured beta decay, then this guy wouldn't be produced here.
Yep.
And then you'd see electrons coming out, carrying off the entire decay energy.
What's wrong with
that? It doesn't occur in nature. So we knew when we measured the electrons.
That you needed it.
Oh, what can you make a theory?
It's an integral part of it.
It is an integral part of nature.
Yeah. So we simplistic.
It's just funny that it goes through everything. It doesn't interact with anything. So what the hell's it there for?
Well, that's why Pauli was embarrassed for producing a particle that might not be detectable. So
that's energetic.
Yeah.
It's also possible if they weren't there that supernovas wouldn't be the same and there wouldn't be any matter in the universe.
Okay,
except hydrogen and helium.
And not biology.
Oh, very good.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so the neutrino was detected, so that was nice. It seemed to kind of complete the story. But then it turned out we had. Yes.
I'm sure you know, but this year's Nobel Prize winner also tried a reactor experiment with cleaning fluid.
That's right.
But it was too small.
Well, he tried a reactor experiment. Of course, he had the wrong kind of neutrino.
Exactly.
In fact,
Right.
Yeah. In fact, Luis Alvarez really first had the idea of doing the chlorine experiment. He didn't do it as a reactor experiment. He did not do that experiment because he suspected that the neutrino and antineutrino would behave differently. They wouldn't see anything. The next little development came a few years later, 3 years later, by Letterman, Schwartz, and Steinberger. And they were looking at another source of neutrinos. Ions decay to produce another particle that's like a heavy electron called a muon, and it's accompanied by a neutrino. And we'll see in a moment that this neutrino is actually not an electron neutrino, the type of neutrino we're talking about here, but the neutrino that accompanies only the muons, a muon-type neutrino. They didn't know that. They did an experiment to find out if this neutrino was the same neutrino as seen in beta decay. So they took this neutrino that was produced in this decay, and they hit targets with it. Let's say a target contained a neutron, and they wanted to see if they would produce an electron plus a proton or a muon plus a proton. The neutrinos were energetic enough that they could produce both of these reactions, energetic enough because the muon is about 100 times more massive than the electron, so you've got to crank up the energy of the neutrino until you've got enough energy to make these reactions go. And what they discovered was, in fact, this reaction did not occur. So somehow the neutrinos that were produced in pi decay were operationally distinct from the neutrinos that appeared in beta decay. They would not do the inverse beta decay reaction of producing an electron and a proton off of a neutron. And in fact, now we know that this story continued with the discovery of the tau neutrino. Physicists don't know why this happens. It's not unique to neutrino physics, but somehow we have these three charged particles, the electron, the muon, and the tauon, of steadily light, medium mass, and very heavy. Each of these guys is associated with in weak interactions with a distinct neutrino, an electron type, a muon type, and a tau type neutrino. And they do, as far as we know, until recently, they don't mix. That is, that what happens to the electron neutrino, what electron neutrino does is distinct from what a muon neutrino does operationally, and so forth. And again, the kinds of, we go back to Fermi's theory of product of two currents. You can go ahead and generalize that theory very simply by saying the current is a little bit more complex than the one that Fermi first wrote down. So you would write down a leptonic current that talks about these three distinct families that would allow electrons to interact with electron neutrinos, that would allow muons to interact with, this is bad notation now, muons interact with u neutrinos and tauons to interact with tau neutrinos. And those three spheres would be kept separate.
Body in what we call the standard model of particle physics. The standard model tells us that these weak interactions that are occurring here involve not only just
leptonic currents, but the hadronic currents. We've been talking about semi-leptonic interactions. So the currents that appear here actually can be further generalized to include a piece that has to do with hadrons and a piece to do with leptons. So these leptons, again, are the electrons, the muons, the tauons, and their associated neutrinos. The hadrons, protons, and neutrons, and heavier particles, actually the underlying particles are the quarks that makes up those protons and neutrons. And they allow the hadronic current would correspond to the light quarks and the heavier quarks. So the D quark, the strange quark, and the bottom quark. Those are the guys that would be created from interactions. So these fellows would talk to one another through a current operator. And unlike the case that appears up here, where the electron only talks to the electron neutrino, the muon only talks to the muon neutrino, and the tauon only talks to the tau neutrinos. We already know from experiments a long time ago that there's some mixing between these guys. That is, that the, skip one line here, up, charge. So these are the plus charged quarks, and these are the negatively charged quarks. And so the first family quark analogous to an electron talking to an electron neutrino would be an up quark decaying into a down quark. That would be the thing that would drive a proton decaying into a neutron. That's the underlying physics that goes into that decay of the composite particle. Likewise, the charm in the top quark would decay into the strange quark in the bottom quark. Instead of this, those currents being this matrix being a diagonal matrix, meaning that it has this form here, where only families of one particles of one family talk only to themselves, particles of another family only to themselves, particles of a third family only to themselves. There's a non-trivial matrix that appears here, not a diagonal matrix. So there's some probability for the up quark to decay, not to the down quark, but that's a few percent probability into a strange quark as well. So they're mixing between these neutrino species. In the standard model, there's a corresponding leptonic current that we'd write down here. The leptonic current is shown right up here, which would have the same form, would not have this mixing matrix. And the reason would not have this mixing matrix is in the standard model, these neutrinos all are all degenerate. They all have the same mass. So we can immediately diagonalize the matrix at no cost because these states are all degenerate. So you just pick the guys that diagonalize that mass as being, define those as being the new E and the new mu and the new tau. You can't do that for the quarks, the up quark, the charm quark, and the top quark, because those are particles of definite mass. So you can't form some linear combination. These are defined as the mass eigenstates. And in the standard model, it's assumption that the neutrinos are non-zero mass that allows you to make that matrix immediately into a diagonal matrix. The interactions that then occur, though, are just like Fermi described, at least at low energies. It's a product of this current with itself. So you can see that weak interactions can involve hadronic currents talking to hadronic currents, hadronic currents talking to leptonic currents. That was the beta decay where a proton or neutron was involved in one vertex and the neutrinos and then the electron on the others. Or leptonic currents can talk to leptonic currents. That would allow a neutrino, for example, to scatter off an electron. An example of a hadronic interaction would mean that there's a very small contribution to the nuclear force that's due to weak interactions. Terribly small, would be very, very difficult to measure unless one had some trick to play. There is one more little detail that's embodied in the standard model. Standard model has these massive neutrinos. Fermi made one mistake, and the mistake was not discovered until 1957, and that is that there's an apparent maximal violation of parity in the weak interactions. And so until 1957, it was thought that physics was always invariant if you looked at a mirror. That is, if you looked at a reaction in real space, looked at the same reaction that would through a mirror. Oh, hi, Boris. One would not be able to tell that one was looking in a mirror. The physics would be the same, invariant under a mirror reflection. Turned out that the weak interaction is among the fundamental forces in nature, is the interaction that violates that mirror symmetry. And in fact, it violates it maximally. So the weak particles that are produced in weak interaction have a definite handedness, which means that if you think about a massless particle moving in some direction and having a spin, these are all spin and half leptons that we're talking about, all the particles are spinning left-handed, which means that you have to put your thumb opposite the direction of motion and do that screw to get the direction of spin, while the antiparticles have their spin along the direction of motion. So you can tell if you have particles going at you and spinning in this direction, and you look at it in this mirror, the spin remains the same under mirror reflection, but the direction is flipped, so it looks like you've changed the helicity of the spin of that particle. So this V minus A nature of the weak interaction is interesting because it does something to the weak interaction does something that allows it to be distinguished from the other much stronger strong interaction and electromagnetic interactions. So for example, one can see the effects of the weak interaction in a hadronic system by measuring the parity violation that's associated with this definite handedness. Now this kind of helps to explain this experiment that went on over here when Letterman et al. First showed that these neutrinos that were produced in pi decay were of a particular type, a muon type. In fact, they're not exactly muon type. If you look at the decay of a pion, so we'll make this the pion sitting at rest in its rest frame, into a muon in a neutrino or an electron in a neutrino, then you can imagine a decay like this. And there's a, in such a decay, since these are, this is a guy sitting at rest, there's orbital angular momentum in the problem, but the orbital angular momentum is always perpendicular to the scattering plane, because the particles are all on a plane. So the orbital angular momentum sticks out of the board. And then one could look at the angular momentum algebra sitting in the board. Well, he just said that the weak interaction violates parity maximally, and this is a particle, not an antiparticle. It means that it has a spin that's pointed in this direction. But the mu plus is considered an antiparticle in the standard model, so it has a spin pointed in that direction. And that would be exact in the limit that these particles are treated as massless particles. So you'd find, since this was a spin zero object decaying, and these two spins are going to have to add up to give you a spin one object, that this would violate angular momentum if this indeed was a massless particle. So the two choices that you have for this decay, decaying into a muon or decaying into an electron, the pi mass is just a little bit heavier than a muon mass. And so, in fact, there are large corrections to this exact helicity because of the large muon neutrino mass, while the positron is much lighter than the pion. So essentially, this argument that forbids this decay is suppresses the E plus nu E channel and enhances the mu plus nu mu channel. So when you put in this relativity, you find out that this rate goes roughly, the ratio of these two rates, muon to electron, goes as the ratio of the muon neutrino mass to the electron neutrino mass squared, plus some corrections, and that's on the order of 10 to the 4. The mass of the muon and electron goes to the fact, goes like, gives you a factor of 10 to the 4 enhancement of the decay channel into the muons instead of the electrons. So in this decay of the pion, the muon is the preferred channel. So indeed, Letterman's experiment did involve a particular neutrino that we understood 2 years later because of this of the effects of parity violation. And that mu turned out to be operationally distinct from the electron neutrino. Now, there's some interesting questions you can ask about neutrinos. A couple of times I've written down neutrinos and anti-neutrinos. And so that means particle and antiparticle. And that's a familiar concept in physics. For example, if you have an electron, then you define the antiparticle as the particle that carries the opposite. All the additive charges, all the additive quantum numbers have the opposite value in an antiparticle. In a sense, if you added up the additive quantum numbers for a particle and an antiparticle, they annihilate each other. So if you have an electron, the electron's antiparticle is a positron. And the positron is definitely distinct from electron because the electron has a negative charge and the positron has a positive charge. And all the other non-neutrino fermions, similar particles in the standard model, always have that property that they each carry a charge. So the particle has to be, the antiparticle has to be distinct from the particle because that antiparticle has the opposite charge. One of the issues that showed up for the neutrino was that when you write down a neutrino, it doesn't carry any charge. There's no obvious quantum number to associate with the neutrino that distinguishes the neutrino from its antiparticle. So in fact, this question of writing down a neutrino and an antineutrino is a little bit ambiguous. So you could try to make some progress, and a lot of these things were thought about, again, before the discovery of parity violation. It led to some prejudices. Let's try to make a little bit of an argument where we say define the electron neutrino. What are we going to define it as? We're going to define it as the particle that is produced in beta plus decay. So you have a nucleus that decays and spits out a positron. Then the associated neutrino is just defined as a neutrino. And then you find that if you take that neutrino and you add it and hit a neutron with it, as we've done before, you produce a proton and an electron. You take that same neutrino and try to hit a proton target, nothing happens. You don't produce a neutron and E plus, even though that reaction also conserves the charges. Electron neutrinos induce the first reaction, but not the second. You could also then try to define the antiparticle. So the antineutrino will define as the particle produced in beta minus decay. And then if you do the experiments, you find if you take an antineutrino, as Reines and Cowan did, hit a proton, it produces a neutron plus an E plus. If you do the same experiment as above, but switch the proton to neutron target, add it to a neutron, you produce a proton and an E minus. It does not go. Thank you. So it seems obvious from those statements that the neutrino and the antineutrino must be distinct because they operationally they do different things on these targets. And that was the prejudice that therefore you had to introduce a quantum number that would distinguish the neutrino from its antiparticle. That quantum number is called lepton number, so LE. So we assign LE equal to plus 1 for the new E and for the E minus, and LE equal to minus 1 for the new E bar and the E plus. And the conservation law is that you sum the lepton numbers going into a reaction, and that has to equal the sum of the lepton numbers going out of a reaction. So this first reaction here involves a neutrino that has lepton number plus 1 in the initial state, and a final state that involves an electron that has lepton number plus 1. So it's allowed because the lepton number is additively conserved. And you look at the second reaction here, and the initial state has lepton number plus 1, but the final state has lepton number minus 1. So that violates lepton number conservation. It's forbidden. So it's a little law you can make up that there's a conserved lepton number in this model that we're building, this standard model, that seems to explain experimentally what we see. Unfortunately, there's a little glitch in this argument. It doesn't really address this issue of antiparticle behavior because of this Gaviria parity violation. You have to do something to distinguish the reactions here. But you can also go in and say that the neutrino that appears here is the left-handed particle, and only left-handed particles are allowed to produce this reaction. This is forbidden for right-handed particles. And likewise, the antineutrino here is a right-handed guy. So we can erase this bar here. Just say it's the right-handed state of the neutrino. And the right-handed state of that neutrino can induce that reaction, but not this reaction here. So it's equivalent in terms of explaining what we see in nature, just to say it's the left and right-handed neutrinos that allow these reactions to occur. They're forbidden for the opposite-handedness. So that caused a lot of confusion early on because we had this prejudice for a lepton number, but in fact, it's equally true that it's possible to explain this thing just in terms of the fact that the handedness of the neutrino is exact. Now, why this is kind of intriguing is that there's a nice way nature does of doing the experiments that are written over there. And she does it in this process called double beta decay. This has to do with the fact that there are something like 50 isotopes in nature, nuclei that exist, that are technically not stable. That is, if you plot the masses of these isotopes, you'll find a situation where this is a nucleus of charge Z, mass A. There's a neighboring nucleus that has mass A, Z plus 1, another one, mass A, Z plus 2. And then other guys here with successively higher charges. And so if you look at the table of isotopes, that is, if you have a set of nuclei that all have the same mass number and all you're doing is redistributing the protons and neutrons, which you can do by beta decay, then this is the lowest state for this system of A nucleons. So you expect the system to decay until it gets to this lowest state, and that's the nucleus we should find in nature, the non-radioactive stable nucleus that should exist of this sort. Unfortunately, you've got this odd behavior here that the nucleus that has a Z plus 1 protons is energetically higher. That's what this represents, the plot of mass as a function of species here. So this is the lowest state. This is the next lowest state. And in between these guys is a nucleus that sits here, which is you cannot reach by beta decay because you have to go up. You have to produce energy to generate this state. So the only way that this nucleus A and Z, once it's produced by some reaction, can decay is to decay spontaneously down to this down to this parent nucleus of this sort. It cannot go by ordinary first order beta decay. So how does that actually look in nature? So we can make our two neutrons that are embedded in this nucleus of A and Z. We can have one of them produced by the weak interaction, an electron. That means that it's accompanied by what we call this antineutrino, or this right-handed neutrino. And then we would like to induce this reaction over here to produce another electron, to produce a final state of two protons and two electrons to take us from A of Z to A of Z plus 2. That's a process called double beta decay. It's very rare. We know the lifetimes for such decays are exceed 10 to the 25 years. Now, this last reaction that occurs here, let's just put a little break here. This reaction that would occur, since you produced an electron, has to be a neutrino. So it again seems to test this question of the distinction between the electron neutrino and the electron antineutrino. So if there was a conserved lepton number, that is, if the electron neutrino state were absolutely different from the electron antineutrino state, this would be forbidden under all conditions. However, if it's just a matter of felicity, that is, that it's not that the neutrino and its antineutrino are distinct, but in fact they have different handednesses, the handednesses are exact only if the neutrinos are truly absolutely massless. So if this is the case, that this is a right-handed neutrino, and we're asking how much left-handed neutrino might be buried in there, it turns out this would happen if the neutrino is massive. And in fact, the decay rate for this process goes like the square of the neutrino mass. So this is a way, essentially, of distinguishing whether there's an absolutely conserved lepton number in our model of underlying physics, or whether it's just the case that this is suppressed because the neutrino masses are much smaller. And this has to do with the fact that the neutrino, in some way, is more flexible than the other particles that we know about in the standard model. Because the electrons and the quarks carry charges, we know that there's only one way we can form their masses in the standard model. It's a so-called Dirac mass. This guy here, because of the fact that it doesn't have this constraint that the particles and antiparticles are different, essentially allows another kind of mass called a Majorana mass. And so there's more possibilities for generating the mass of neutrinos. If we sit down or to write down the interactions that generate the masses of these particles, not generate the mass, but represent the masses of these particles, the Dirac masses, which would be there for an electron and a positron, would be of the form where a right-handed field talks to a left-handed field through the mass, whatever that mass is that's generated by other parts of the standard model. And the Majorana mass, which violates this lepton number, that it would allow this reaction to occur, involves fields of the same helicity, but charge conjugated. And it's essentially these things that are new in the neutrino sector that can't be there for the charged particles. And it plays an interesting role, and I'll just give a hand-waving argument. One of the questions in the standard model is that you would like to generalize it beyond what we know about today to include new interactions that we think beyond the standard model. We'd like to explain a lot of the parameters that exist just as parameters in the standard model. And one natural thing to start with, since we talked about these three families, electron, muon, and tauon, that you might want to put the particles of a given generation, a given family, together in some more complicated multiplet than we have in the standard model. Efforts to do that, for instance, if you take the up and down quark and the electron, the positron, and the neutrino, and wanted to package those guys together, then the fellows that build models would like to generate the masses of these particles. So they would couple this to some field that generates these masses. And immediately there's a problem because of this neutrino. Because if you look at the up and down quarks, look at their masses are the order of sort of 5 MeV. The positron is the order of a half an MeV. So the masses are all comparable. But the neutrino is much, much lighter than the other particles. It doesn't fit in some sense. It doesn't fit because it's 10 to the 5, at least 10 to the 5 orders of magnitude lighter than the electron and the positron. So how does one build a more general theory that treats the first generation particles, for example, if that's your goal, together in a way, and yet explains the fact that the neutrino is so different from the other particles in terms of its masses? Well, this is connected in this idea called the seesaw with the fact that the neutrino mass is, in fact, more general than the possibilities for generating the neutrino masses are more general than for the other particles. The up and down and quark and the positron have Dirac masses. The electron neutrino can have a Dirac mass and a Majorana mass. So the game that's played is that there's a mass matrix that's generated, which has these Dirac terms for the neutrinos, and then in particular has this right-handed Majorana mass that's special to neutrinos. So the underlying mass for the neutrinos is of this form, and when you diagonalize a matrix of this guy, you get two eigenstates, the light eigenstate of which is of the form the conventional mass, M sub Dirac, that would be the mass that it would have in common with the up and down quark and the positron. And then this is what you're looking for, the needed small parameter that explains why the neutrino mass is so much lighter than the other particles in the same family. It's the ratio of this Dirac mass to some new right-handed Majorana scale. So the notion of neutrinos being light in the standard model is connected in beyond the standard model physics with the notion that there may be new mass scales, new phenomena that occur way beyond the energy scales that we probe right now. And what we're seeing in the neutrino with the lightness of neutrinos is, in fact, the suppression factor of the ratio of our ordinary physics to this physics we've not yet discovered. So the very lightness of neutrinos is somehow connected to these very high energy scales that we hope to discover indirectly by measuring these small masses of neutrinos. So how do you measure neutrino masses? The experimentalist has to do something to detect these guys. This is one way, this process of double beta decay. It turns out that the mass that's measured here is a little complicated. It's not just the electron neutrino mass, but in fact the sums over all the neutrino masses. And it has to do with a particular part of the mass that comes from these Majorana terms. This is one direct way of measuring. This is one way of measuring a mass. And we know that from this thing here, with this process here, that the electron neutrino is probably less than something on the order of half an electron volt. That is, it's about 10 to the 6 times smaller, lighter than the electron neutrino. Another process, we talked about this beta decay of a proton to a neutron plus a positron and a neutrino, for example. You could look at a beta decay reaction of this sort, or the analogous neutrino to proton plus electron plus antineutrino, and study this very, very carefully, the spectrum of electron energies. If the electron neutrino has a small mass, then the maximum energy carried off by the positron is less than it would be if the electron neutrino had no mass. So the experimentalist study the spectrum of emitted positrons, look at the very highest energy positrons emitted, and try to see if there's a little deviation from the expected phase space curve that Fermi first predicted. And this tells us today that we know the electron neutrino mass is something, again, less than about 2.2 electron volts. And then there's another thing that can be done, and this is where all the excitement has come in the last few years, a third kind of test of neutrino masses, and that's the phenomenon of neutrino oscillations. We mentioned before, if in the standard model, if neutrinos were massive, then we can make this current that we form for the neutrinos talking to the charged leptons diagonal. But now if we introduce a mass, if we assume we're testing the fact that the different neutrinos might have different masses, that rotation is no longer possible. What that tells you is that you should think, we're going to live in a world where there are only two neutrinos now, just for simplicity. So in that world, there are two Hamiltonians that we could write down. One would be the weak Hamiltonian, and the other would be the Hamiltonian that describes the particles of definite mass, so how free particles propagate in space. The eigenstates of this weak Hamiltonian are what we call the new E, and we'll say here the new mu. So when a weak interaction occurs, it produces a state. If that state's accompanied by an electron, we call that a new E. If it's accompanied by a muon, we call that a new mu. The Hamiltonian described mass knows nothing about the weak interaction, just describes free particle propagation. And the guys that diagonalized that fellow are neutrinos nu1 and nu2. which we mean by nu 1 is a guy that has definite mass m1. This guy has definite mass m2. We're going to assume for the moment that m1 is not equal to m2. We have massive neutrinos, and they're not somehow accidentally degenerate. And therefore, these are just different bases for describing the same physics, though. It's the same, it's a two-state problem. You can describe it in terms of one set of eigenstates or another set of eigenstates. So if you have a, if you just choose to describe a neutrino of definite mass, it must be a linear combination of the neutrinos of definite flavor. So we would write down an equation like this, giving that relationship. And this mixing angle here is just a convenient way of writing the fact that it's some kind of a combination of nu e and nu mu sum to unit amplitude. And likewise, a nu 2 would then have to be the opposite combination. So now we can, and we can, of course, invert that to rewrite the nu e in terms of the nu mu as well. So it's fine to kind of do a Gedanken experiment of producing a neutrino state at time t equal to 0 from beta decay. That's an electron neutrino. And throwing a few things under the rug, let's just say that we produce this state with a definite momentum, pre-momentum. So we produce a neutrino, and then we let it propagate downstream. We're going to measure that neutrino downstream somewhere. So initially, by adding these guys up, we know at time t equal to 0, this guy has to be cosine theta of nu 1 and minus sine theta of nu 2. That particular linear combination of nu 1 and nu 2 is defined as the electron neutrino. But then we do our quantum mechanics and describe what happens down there when t is not equal to 0, somewhere downstream. So what happens? Well, these guys propagate downstream as plane waves. They had the same momentum, so they're e to the I p dot x, their standard wave of spatial propagation. That gives you a common phase. But they also propagate according to a time behavior that goes like e to the I energy minus energy times time. And because they had the same momentum and different masses, they have different energies. So it turns out when you put in that different energy here, that there's a phase that's accumulated. So this turns out downstream to accumulate a phase that goes like I to the e 1. So we'll call that square root of p squared plus m1 squared times time, and then minus sine theta. And another phase here, which is the distinct phase, minus I, times the square root, again, by assumption, the same momentum, that mass m2 squared times time times nu 2. And so you can see that because these phase factors are different because of the different masses of the two guys, they're no longer in the same linear combination that constitute the nu e. So this is no longer a nu e, but some combination of the nu e and the nu mu. So now it's just a matter of details. You can go and expand this thing, assuming that m1 squared is a very small number. And then you can dagger this against the state that you know to be a new, the nu mu, to find out how much nu mu there is in this nu e. So we won't do the details here, but it's really easy to do. But when that calculation is run through, you find out that the probability of measuring a nu mu downstream, which we'll define as the overlap of the muon neutrino with the neutrino that we produce at some time t, you find out is proportional to this twice the angle describing the relation of the mass eigenstates that make up this neutrino. Delta m squared, this is m2 squared minus m1 squared times t divided by 4 times the momentum. So t is the same thing as distance, is how far downstream you looked at this neutrino. This is an oscillatory factor that goes through 2 pi and goes through 2 pi again. This is just some constant that's sitting out in front. So it tells you this probability of measuring a new mu oscillates. At one point in space, you see it's at time t equal to 0, it's all electron neutrino, no muon neutrino. Then some piece of muon neutrino grows in, never gets bigger than sine squared of 2 theta, and then it grows out again. So the probability of seeing this muon neutrino oscillates. And it's a measure of the differences in the mass squares of these neutrinos. So that's the third way of measuring neutrino mass.
Wait, this is probably unfair, but
construction. I asked you if there are any sailors under the rug.
What's under the rug is you got to be really careful about how you build this way packet here. Yeah. And so you get this. We're going to have more arguments because Harry Lipkin is going to come and argue about this soon. And there was a marvelous experiment that was done way before its time, launched in 1965, where this physics first came up. And it was actually an experiment done for a different reason. Ray Davis Jr. wanted to test how the sun burned. The sun is a thermonuclear reactor, and it converts through something called a P-P chain, four protons into helium, producing two electron neutrinos as a sort of byproduct, plus two positrons. And there's a fairly complicated chain of nuclear reactions by which that's accomplished called the P-P chain. But these neutrinos were produced, and a particular portion of those neutrinos are of high energy, high enough energy so Ray Davis had this idea of measuring them. He built a detector containing a bunch of cleaning fluid deep in the home state mine, and when these solar neutrinos hit cleaning fluid, which contained chlorine, it converts the chlorine to argon. And argon is a marvelous noble gas that can be extracted from very, very large quantities of organic fluid, essentially atom by atom. So Ray was able to measure in this huge tank that consisted, well, it took 10 railway carloads worth of cleaning fluid to fill his tank. And in that tank, he managed to measure a conversion rate from solar neutrinos hitting that material of about a 2/5 of an atom produced per day in this huge volume. That's for which he won the Nobel Prize. And then there was a fellow, John Bacall, and others who worked out what the standard model of the sun should predict in terms of that neutrino flux. So you were able to compare the flux of neutrinos measured to the flux of neutrino predicted in the standard solar model. And the answer turned out to be about a third. In other words, 2/3 of the neutrinos were missing. Now, there was great controversy about this for the next 30 years because the particular neutrinos that Ray Davis was measuring were hard to predict. They depended on the 22nd power of the core temperature of the sun. So if you made a 5% mistake in estimating that core temperature, you could account for the fact you wasn't seeing the right number of neutrinos. So it took a lot of theory effort and a lot of supporting experiments to really demonstrate that this shortage was true. But Korval pointed out a long time ago that one possible explanation for this, since the reaction on chlorine is only induced by electron-type neutrinos, was that electron neutrinos might have converted into the muon neutrinos on the way to the Earth, and therefore it could be particle physics and not a problem with the sun. That accounted for that problem. And in fact, it's even, if you just give me, I'm running out of time here, but I want to show you a real kind of cute little picture of how to think about these oscillations. And it's a problem we've all done in first-year mechanics when we do coupled oscillators. So we're going to call the oscillator on the left here as the electron neutrino, and the oscillator on the right the muon neutrino. When we say we have an electron neutrino, it corresponds to being motion in that neutrino. So if the electron neutrino is swinging and the muon pendulum is sitting like this, that means there's no muon neutrino, but there is an electron neutrino because this guy's going back and forth. So these two pendula are the analog of these flavor eigenstates. So what is the analog of the mass eigenstates that appear in this problem? Well, they're the normal modes. So normally when we do a problem like this with equal oscillators, you calculate the mass eigenstates, the normal modes. So in this problem as written here, the normal modes are the fluxing mode like this and plus the mode where they're going like those. So those are the two locked modes. If you produce those modes, just like mass eigenstates, that it stays in that eigenstate forever, that normal mode forever. Just as if you produce a mass eigenstate and let it travel through free space, it's going to stay in that mode forever. But if you start in a new E mode, electron-type mode, then it doesn't stay in there forever if there's coupling, if there's mixing between these guys. So we put in a little spring, and that little spring corresponds to this weak mixing angle that we've written down over here. So this is the analog of neutrino oscillations. And since we think we know that the new mu is probably heavier than the new E, we're going to represent that by having a much longer oscillator here. So now we can go ahead and do this problem. We produce a new E, and what happens as a function of time? Do you produce a little bit of new mu? And the answer is you do. You grab this guy by a weak spring, so it starts to rocking. But you'll also note this oscillator is moving very rapidly, and this oscillator is moving very slowly. So in fact, you're pushing sometime in phase, but then in a few seconds later, you're pushing out of phase. So you can quickly see you never get this new mu to rock very much. It's always just moving a little bit, then it stops, and it's moving a little bit again, and it stops, because the spring is weak and because that you're never pushing at the resonant frequency of the second oscillator. So that's really very analogous to this sine squared 2 theta being small, being weak, and then the mass squared difference never giving you a very, then the coupling never giving you a very large effect. Now, a marvelous thing happens in the sun that complicates and makes more interesting the same picture, and that is that the electron neutrinos and the muon neutrinos react with the surrounding electrons and matter in the sun. And it's just like photons traveling through water. Photons traveling through water react with the material. There's an effective potential that affects the dispersion relation for the photon. The result is that photon doesn't travel in water with the speed of light, but it acts as a massive particle. There's the same kind of effective mass that it contributes to neutrinos when they pass through matter. And a net effect, the differential effect, is that that matter effect makes the new E heavier than the new mu. Specifically, the new E can scatter off the electrons through the charge current, and there's no analogous reaction for the new mu. So in fact, we took the same picture of a solar neutrino produced in the center of the sun, and then asked what happens. You have to have three pictures. The first picture would be at the core of the sun where there's a lot of matter around. The electron neutrino is very long, and the muon neutrino is what it is over here. And by this light length, I really mean is that this portion here has nothing to do with the vacuum properties of the neutrino, but is entirely due to matter. However, if you go to a very high density, the electron neutrino now is much longer than the muon neutrino. So the physical picture here is exactly the same as it was before, even though the roles are reversed. This oscillator is too long to resonantly excite this oscillator. So this, as drawn here, you would have electron neutrinos, a little bit of muon neutrinos, but not very much mixing. Of course, the magic thing about producing a neutrino at the center of the sun is that the neutrino travels out and goes to less and less dense parts of the sun. So a few seconds later, as it's making its transit out of the sun, then in fact what happens is the following. You again have these oscillators like this, but now the matter effects is just exactly right to make these two oscillators degenerate. So at this point, these two oscillators are the electron neutrino is pushing the muon neutrino at exactly the right frequency. So if you don't pass through this density too quickly, you expect these two modes to be completely locked, the two degenerate modes, quasi-degenerate modes at this point. And then the last little step for the quantum mechanics is to ask, what happens now if I go to the surface of the sun? At the surface of the sun, this green part goes away entirely. So what state does the system wind up in? And there's sort of an old theorem from quantum mechanics that tells you if you have two locked modes like this and you move one of the modes out of resonance, that what happens is that the energy remains in the mode that remain close to the original frequency of the locked mode. So in fact, when you've moved this guy out of the way, so you have a short oscillator, this guy is hanging down here, and all the motion is over here in the muon side. So in fact, this neat effect of the matter in the sun winds up with the complete conversion of the new E to the new mu. So these are sort of the ideas that were around. Lincoln Wolfenstein here first pointed out these matter effects on neutrinos in the sun. And this description that goes by the name of the Mikhaev-Smirnov-Wolfenstein mechanism. So over the past few years, we've known about the solar neutrino anomaly. And then I'll just finish up here by showing you what we've learned. And we've learned a lot in the past couple of years. So before the most recent experiments that I'll tell you about, this is a picture of how things looked maybe 6 or 8 years ago. And Ray Davis's experiment is one called Homestake here. The Kamiokande experiment is a water Cherenkov detector that confirmed what Ray Davis saw. First built in Japan as a proton decay detector. SAGE and GALAX are experiments very much like Ray's experiment, but involving a different material, gallium, that was special because it could count the low-energy solar neutrinos. And then with these three experiments, you put on a graph of this mixing angle versus the mass difference, the two parameters we came up with. You write down the solutions that would solve these three separate experiments, and they correspond to curves in this plane that have to do with this adiabatic level crossing. So that's the underlying theory. So the green and the red and the blue curves turn out to intersect. There's a common solution for all three experiments only in certain areas. So we found that there are solutions that are called a large mixing angle, small mixing angle, because these are large and small mixing angles, and the so-called low probability solution that existed. So there are various possibilities for accounting for the solar neutrino problem. And then within the last couple of years, some amazingly powerful new experiments were done. It's hung up. Okay, I can do it without this. So some amazing experiments were done. There were sort of two. One was a much larger version of Kamiokande, which gave much better statistics. And the second was a particular experiment that was unique because it saw not only the electron neutrinos, but in one channel, the electron neutrinos scattering off of deuterium, heavy water, producing an outgoing electron and two protons. But it had a neutral current channel with a neutrino scattering off of a nucleus, breaking the nucleus up into a proton and a neutron. And that neutral current channel is special because regardless of whether a neutrino is an electron neutrino, a muon neutrino, or a tau neutrino, the cross-section for that reaction is the same. So it had one reaction that can measure only the electron-type neutrinos, another reaction that can measure the total number of neutrinos. What was found from these experiments, and in fact these solutions go away, that there's one solution left over, it's the so-called large mixing angle. And sure enough, Ray Davis was right, that two-thirds of the solar neutrinos are either new mus or new taus, and one-third are the heavy flavor neutrinos. And so we measured this mixing between what we call the first and the second neutrino. You can think of it as a new E and the new mu. Because it's a large mixing angle, it's really quite interesting physics because large mixing angles haven't been seen before in particle physics. So it appears that somehow the electron neutrino is sort of an equal admixture of two pieces, almost equal admixture. So this was this two-flavor picture. The same set of experiments, or analogous set of experiments, were done in another way using another source of neutrinos, atmospheric neutrinos. And the atmospheric neutrinos, neutrinos that are typically about a GeV, are roughly two orders of magnitude more energetic than the solar neutrinos. The same kind of phenomena was seen there. That is, if you looked at neutrinos as a function of how far the neutrino was produced in the Earth atmosphere, if you look at neutrinos produced directly above your detector versus on the other side of the Earth, that you began to see as a function of distance a different flux of neutrinos. That's again a sign of this oscillation because we said that the oscillation probability varied as a function of distance. It was again a perfect fit. Remarkable thing about the atmospheric neutrino oscillations is it corresponded to a different mass squared difference. So what we know today is that there is a one oscillation between nu 1 and nu 2 that accounts for the solar neutrino problem, and another oscillation between the muon neutrino and the tauon neutrino that apparently accounts for the atmospheric neutrino oscillations. So we know two mass differences, we know two mixing angles, and both of the mixing angles appear to be maximal, which is a surprise. There's much more to be learned about this system. We don't know the absolute scale of the neutrino mass. So all we measure are mass differences. So we don't know what the offset is for those masses. So one possibility that's still open is that neutrinos are a really important part of dark matter. From the experiments that we've done now, all one knows that neutrinos are at least as important as visible stars in their contribution to the total mass budget of the universe. But it's still an open possibility is that they're as much as 40 times the mass in the stars is accounted for in neutrinos. If that were true, they'd be a major player in determining the large-scale structure we see in the universe. So I think later on this program will have one of the guys that are doing neutrino astrophysics tell you about a number of the ways that neutrinos might influence astrophysics and cosmology. So I'll stop there.
Are there any questions?
Technical, what's left for LSND?
Well, LSND is still in a third experiment that sees an oscillation effect that doesn't correspond to either of these mass differences. So there's a lot of skepticism about that because with the three neutrinos we know about, you can't explain the LSND data. So what's left for LSND is that experiment has to be confirmed, and the effort is underway in Mini-Boone at Fermilab to try to do that sometime in the next 4 years.
But if all the other measurements are right, then they won't see any effect?
Not necessarily. If all the other experiments are right and there are only three neutrinos, then they won't see anything with Mini-Boone.
How much dark matter is missing?
Well, it's believed that it cannot all be of the sort that it's talking about here. The dark matter here is the so-called hot dark matter because it involves light relativistic particles. So if you believe the current analyses, roughly there's missing dark energy, which we really don't know what it is, except that it influences the light curves we see from a certain kind of supernovae as a function of difference, and there's dark matter. And most of the guys who do the large-scale structure simulations are very happy with most of the dark matter being of a different type, so-called cold dark matter, but with some neutrino contribution. So what that mix is, we don't know. The one thing we do know firmly is that there is one kind of dark matter, and it is neutrinos, and we know that there's a minimum value for that. That is something on the order of 0.003 of the closure density.
Okay.